getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
We're back. Dialect. In-depth interviews with some of the unsung heroes of the city, the nation, and the world. Hear the latest show every Tuesday at 12 noon here on BCFM 93.2.
You've heard, of course, that there have been two attempts on my life.
I have.
I consider Blake to be responsible. Oh, not personally, of course. But stories of his exploits are still circulating. They excite people. The fact that he is still free gives them hope, and that is dangerous, Travis. Hope is very dangerous.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Jimmy Savile, Hillsborough, Orgreave, David Kelly, Chilcot and nobody prosecuted. Whatever happened to British justice? Next week, the secret rulers of the Western world get together with the apex of the German government, all there to plan how to keep Britain out of the EU. We look behind the mainstream media wizard of Oz curtain to find how our futures are decided behind closed doors by groups such as NATO and the Bilderbergers, who have some very real and disturbing connections to the Nazis. Also, as I said, Jimmy Savile, Hillsborough, Orgreave, the Birmingham Six, all these varying degrees, proven perjury by police and other officials who never face prosecution by the police or the Crown Prosecution Service. Now, Deep Cut Barracks 2. We take a close look tonight at what was going on at Deep Cut, why Nicholas Blake QC's multi-million pound official inquiry came to the ridiculous conclusion that four soldiers actually committed suicide. And look at the four trainee soldiers almost certainly murdered at Deep Cut and ask, is the British legal system fit for purpose? An answer, no. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Our sister show Dialects back at noon every Tuesday. More from Ian Fleming novel Decoder, US Marine Corps veteran, combat reformer Mike Sparks this week, as he gives us the background to the rise of fascism in the United States, right the way back to the 1934 coup attempt against President Roosevelt, organised by George W. Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush. That's at noon next Tuesday. But first, I'm joined on the line, I hope anyway, by Andy Thomas. Hi Andy, welcome to the Politics Show. I think we better just plunge straight into the next story we're going to have a look at, which is to do with the Israelis, actually. Martin, there's been a big... It's been massive news in Israel, but it's been almost virtually not here in Britain whatsoever. What we've seen is a knife being kicked towards a Palestinian assailant after an Israeli soldier shot him this week. A video introduced the manslaughter trial of the Israeli soldier for the shooting dead of a wounded Palestinian assailant has shown a knife being kicked towards the assailant's body after the fact. So there was a guy basically lying down, they were saying he was a knife attacker, lying down on the ground, and yet the soldier shoots him, it seems, in the head and then kicks a knife towards his body, in other words, trying to frame him.
A lot of violence going on towards Palestinian communities, but it's been overshadowed for us by Brexit, of course, and also, of course, by the war in Syria, which has been pretty gruesome. But, of course, the situation for Palestinians has remained very bad. The human rights abuses against them have increased. And, of course, there's been an awful lot of killings, which are supposedly crazed knife attackers who've just turned out to be random people who've been executed out of hand by the Israeli Defence Forces.
Well, this report is from the Jewish Telegraph Agency, and it's absolutely appalling. It does look as if you've got squads of Israeli soldiers who have been somehow coached in how to you know, basically fit somebody up. So shooting somebody in the head and then kicking a knife over towards their body is a pretty horrific thing to do. You're then just going to say, oh, look, there was a knife on the body, and and accuse them of being there to attack you, when actually what you've done is you've shot an innocent civilian in the head.
Well, there's also evidence that settlers have been attacking Palestinian homes with firebombs, etc., and then when Palestinians retaliate, then they face the full might of the Israeli Defence Forces. It's all happening. I mean, obviously, in Israel itself, this stuff is top of the agenda. But I'm afraid, with our own obsessions, we're losing track of it. But, of course, the Israeli Defence Forces are also sticking their fingers in Syria, as are our own Defence Forces, which is probably closer to home from our point
of view. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defence Minister Moshe Yalon immediately condemned the killing at the time, but then they I don't know about Yalon, but Netanyahu, first thing he did was call the soldier's father, and what many saw as a sign of support for him.
Yes, well, I mean, basically, you know, when you see somebody shot in the head who's clearly, basically disarmed, if nothing else, there's a clear breach of law, of international law there. But I'm afraid within Israel itself, a very nasty right-wing mood has developed where the lives of Palestinians simply are not regarded as the same as other human lives.
This is the problem, isn't it? At the time, this did go all the way around the world, this attack, many times around the world as a news story, even though now there's no real reporting of this trial here in the UK. But it went around the world as a knife attack by a Palestinian who the soldiers had to shoot dead.
Well, indeed. And of course, the former Israeli generals have spoken out, actually, saying that what's going on in Israel is comparable to what went on in Nazi Germany in the 30s. These are retired Israeli Defence Force generals who are saying
that. I noticed there's a filmmaker as well that was saying exactly the same. So, yeah, pretty horrific stuff there. But also, something else I would sort of draw quite close to this is the reports during the week that one of the senior Israeli army officers actually went to one of the places which was supposed to be completely in control of al-Nusra and ISIS. And this sort of thing, is there any real relationship between
there
the Israeli military?
There is. There's evidence that al-Nusra and ISIS fighters have been taken into Israel for medical treatment and then put back into the fight inside Syria. And in fact, Druze militants in the Golan Heights attacked the ambulances which were carrying these ISIS fighters into Israel, and there was an incident surrounding that. But of course, it's open knowledge in the Middle East by those who know that ISIS and al-Nusra Front are being armed, trained and directed by the Israelis, the British, the Americans, the Saudis and the Qataris. That is, you know, everybody knows that's what's going on. But meanwhile, we're being taught we have to go to war to stop ISIS. Meanwhile, of course, our chaps have been training and arming them. Some mistake, surely.
Well, let's try and regain a connection with Andy Thomas now. Hi, Andy. Can you hear me?
Yeah, hi.
Oh, hurrah! You're there on the phone.
Yeah, the good old telephone.
Good old-fashioned way of doing things. Just to introduce Andy, he's the author of two books that I know of. One is Conspiracies, the Facts, the Theories and the Evidence. The other one is The Truth Agenda, Making Sense of Unexplained Mysteries, Global Cover-Ups, which is the bit which I've underlined, and Visions for a New Era in 2013. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write those, Andy?
Sure. I mean, the thing is, there's so much of this stuff floating around, as you know, which gets branded under the header conspiracy theory. And if you're slightly on the outside of it, it can seem overwhelming. People don't know where to start. They don't quite know how it all pulls together. So what I tried to do in both those books, where Truth Agenda includes a bit more unexplained mystery stuff, as you suggest, whereas Conspiracies is pretty more hardcore real-world stuff for the most part. But it's trying to say, look, what are the binding threads? What's the overall hypothesis here of people that are very concerned about the way the world is going and what we're not being told? So both those books, they try to give you, in as much of a nutshell as you can, the overall impression of what's going on, and give you hopefully enough information that you can then go out there and start to explore the avenues that, you know, speak to you more than anything, and try and do something about it. Because ultimately, if we want to turn all of this kind of stuff around, everybody needs to stand up to the plate and do something, even if it's just one small thing, from saving your local bus shelter to campaigning for anti-corruption on your local council. You know, if everybody did something to try to get to the truth and just stop this, you know, insane world that we're in, which is so obviously manipulated and engineered, we'd all get somewhere. And that's what the books are trying to do, and that's what I try to do in the lectures I give as well, is give people enough to get them started on a road so that we can actually get some serious reform going.
Well, in the media, of course, there's a massive amount of motivation, financial, for disinformation. Why is that?
Well, I mean, you know, the bottom line is always the state, the establishment, it protects itself first and foremost. And I think that's what we're always up against. And in the end, it becomes self-reflexive, because what they're doing is they start off by wanting power. Then when you've got some level of power, of course, you've got to cling on to it. And the only way they can cling on to it is to continually keep the public basically stupid in the dark. And that agenda is obvious. I mean, if you walk around W.H. Smith on any average day and you just look at the magazines that are there, the complete distraction, the mind rot that people have fed, of course, keeps them busy. So then most people don't get drawn to the really important stuff. They're not encouraged to do anything about it, and they don't even know what's going on.
I think it's fair to say, isn't it, that nowadays the stuff that's presented in front of our faces, that is to say even places like Waterstones, the books which are laid out for you as you walk in there, most of that is drivel, nonsense and distraction of various sorts, that now there's an onus on people, mainly, I suppose, using the internet, to actually go out and find things out for themselves. But not everyone has got the time to do that, Andy.
No, and that's why, I mean, it's important that the people that can see what's going on can, as much as possible, give a very clear and as quick a picture as possible to show other people why you need to look beyond that. And you can, and those conduits are there. And as you say, the internet has been an absolute gift, which is, of course, why the establishment would love to control it and shut it down, and they're trying to do that through various nefarious means. But at the moment, the alternative media is alive and strong. More and more people have been drawn to that because they know the BBC, they know the Waterstones or whatever, they're not giving them the whole picture, and we're now seeing that more and more. And even Amazon has started stocking, or rather stopped stocking, certain titles that now they don't approve of. So censorship is starting to creep in on a number of levels, which is very worrying, because if you only look at Amazon to see what books there are. If they're not there, you may never know they exist.
Well, I would recommend, if anyone's going online to try and get hold of a book, go on to bookfinder.com. There are others as well, but, you know, that uses Amazon as one of its places to get hold of a book. But look, one of the things I wanted to do, if possible, with you, Andy, is rather than drill into the detail of this upcoming EU referendum, is to look at some of the sort of much bigger, wider stuff that you and other people have dug out over the years about what's going on with the EU. Because I don't think there's much doubt in my mind that this is a big potential turning point in history, you know, whether we're going to be part of this United States of Europe or not is going to be fascinating to see, and it will have an impact in the future. I mean, even Jeremy Corbyn, various other people have acknowledged this is, particularly for young people, is going to make a massive difference as to the world that they spend most of their lives in the future. And I noticed that you made reference to a book by Toyne Newton called The Occult Origins of the European Union, which sounds to me as if it might be a bit iffy, but it's saying that there is something else going on behind the scenes. The word occult really just means hidden, but it's essentially what you're getting at there. I mean, I remember reading years ago a book by Dionne Fortune, can't remember the title of it, but she was explaining, say, well, mysticism is this kind of airy-fairy stuff that you kind of, you may get in your head, you may get visions or whatever, but the occult is the stuff that is going on behind the scenes which has been completely hidden. That's essentially all it is. So what do you think about the origins of the European Union, occult or otherwise?
Well, I mean, they go back quite a long way. There's another researcher I'd really recommend, a guy called Terry Boardman, and he's got a great website called threeman.org, and he's been giving a lot of talks for a long time about the origins of Europe, the First World War, the Second World War, and he knows his history. And when you look back, you can begin to see certain things falling into place that begin to create a series of superstates. So we all talk about the New World Order. But that is a real project. But it has various conduits which are fed into creating what we now today call the EU. You've got the Pilgrim Society, you've got the Round Table, you've got a lot of sort of machinations early in the 20th century which begin to put people into power who are clearly playing a long game. And one unsung aspect of the whole EU thing, which Terry brings out, and I know you yourself have, is the fact that Europe was very much encouraged into being to suit the Americans. And of course we're now seeing that with the whole TTIP trade deal they're trying to push through, which will make Europe far more malleable to corporate American interests and pretty much ends all idea of sovereignty then and there. So the EU is not what people want it to be. And one interesting thing, a lot of younger people who've been brought up with the EU, and, you know, they've had Common Purpose and groups like this in the background making the EU seem like a good thing to them, they want to stick to it because it's what they know. And in the idealized view of things, they think it's a great collective, it's a good way forward, which in theory it should be, but what they don't see is the way it was set up. It was set up to suit corporate interests. Yes, there is clearly secret society influence in it. And to be fair, Toyn Newton's book is actually very well researched. If you just look at the origins of the signs and symbolisms that were used, you know, from the very start of the whole EU project,
now,
it tells you what you're dealing with.
Yeah, I just stop you there for a second, because one of the things I would say to anyone that's got a euro in their pocket, well, you're doing well if you've got any money at all these days. So many of us are in debt, you know, but if you've got a euro in your pocket, turn it over and have a look on the back. What you've got there is a picture of Europe on the right-hand side and a bridge leading off across the Atlantic. So I don't know what that means in terms of symbolism. It seems pretty obvious, Andy.
Well, I think it is. I mean, you mentioned in your introduction the Bilderberg Group. So this is this slightly shadowy organisation. I mean, it's all admitted and it accepts that it's there, and yet you don't hear much about it. But that was set up in 1954, and I'll give you a direct quote. Quote, designed to foster dialogue between Europe and North America. Now, that's what it says it's there to do. The problem we've got is it's clearly got a lot more clout than they let on. They say it's just a think tank. Well, it's clearly much, much more than that. I mean, in 2010, the former NATO Secretary General, Willy Claes, he actually admitted that Bilderberg does set the global policy basically for the year ahead. What gets discussed there is laying down what's going to happen that year. And in 2009, the then Bilderberg chairman, Etienne Davignon, actually claimed that the euro, the currency, was actually a Bilderberg idea. So if you then look back into these kinds of people who are part of this and the people that attend the Bilderberg meetings, you begin to see, hang on a minute, maybe the EU wasn't set up for our benefit, which is what's being sold to us at the moment. And we've been frightened to say, well, if you leave, you'll have no money, your holidays will cost more, and all of this. It was never set up to serve our needs, the everyday folk, and never will be. It was basically for the people at the top to protect their interests, to protect American interests. And there's a lot more beneath this than is meeting the eye. And the fact that the Bilderberg meetings are hardly known about by most people is, of course, one of the shocking things.
Well, it's not so shocking when you consider that quite a lot of the mainstream media are there as well, big organisations like the BBC, that we're also talking about News International, that seems to be a major part of it, as well as people like The Economist. But when the thing is, when these journalists go there, they are swearing, you know, basically an oath of secrecy that we won't report on this, we will only use it for our own possibly personal benefit and as part of the running of our organisation. And another thing that often gets forgotten is that these media companies increasingly are massive multinational corporations themselves, and so of course they are going to actually be much more interested in a United States of Europe which is run by big corporations, for big corporations, than they are in sort of delivering that fact to the listeners and viewers. But look, you said something a minute ago, Andy, about the US and their involvement in it at the start of the Bilderberg and the European Union, and I caught a clip of Paul Craig Roberts. Now, he's a former US Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy under President Reagan back in the 1980s. And he was talking to Julian Charles on the Mind Renewed podcast recently about this very subject.
Yeah. The EU is a creation of the CIA. And this was discovered some years ago by an American professor who happened upon released documents in the archive of the United States, where public documents are put when they are released from their, you know, their time holding.
Was it Georgetown University? I think I read somewhere.
Georgetown or George Washington, I think it was. But you see, it was reported on by the Telegraph, by Ambrose Evans Pritchard, in the year 2000. And I think I mentioned that in my column, that this was 16 years ago reported in the Telegraph by Ambrose, who was for a while, I guess, the Telegraph's correspondent in Washington. And the documents show that the CIA did this, basically organized, orchestrated, lobbied for the creation of the EU for two reasons. One, as a bloc against the Soviets, and two, as enabling Washington's control, because to control all the separate European governments is much more time-consuming, demanding, involved than controlling an EU government, especially something with an EU commission that's not accountable. And so Washington set it up in order to have a firm hold on its European empire.
And this goes back to, according to Ambrose Evans Pritchard, this goes back to the 1950s and 60s, I understand.
Yes, back to the 50s, I think it was. I don't have my article in front of me, but it was a creation of the CIA as a way of enhancing Washington's empire. You know, for Washington to have to go to Italy, to France, to Germany, to the British, negotiate with each of these governments, the more people you have to bribe or threaten or cajole, and then the countries themselves can increase their demands for what they want in return, because if one holds out, no deal can be made. Whereas if Europe is dissolved, if the European countries are dissolved into one entity, then Washington only has to deal with one entity. And so this was the origin of the EU for that purpose. It facilitates Washington's control, and that is why Washington has pushed so strongly to put all of Eastern Europe into both the EU and NATO, because otherwise, how many countries are there, European? I can't remember the Eastern, the Western, the 28 or 29.
That's the voice of Paul Craig Roberts there, the former U.S. presidential advisor to Ronald Reagan back in the 1980s and in the U.S. cabinet as well, talking about the origins of the EU. Andy, what he's essentially saying there is that if you're going to control 500 million people in Europe, it's much easier to have one organization to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's long been their aim. And another thing that got mentioned there that I think is something that's not understood is Russia, because, I mean, throughout history, Russia's always been kept out of anything to do with any Western negotiations, and America is absolutely, you know, paralyzed with fear that, say, Germany and Russia could become allies.
Well, hang on, because you Russia know, was brought into the G8, wasn't it, for a while?
For a while, but now, if you look at what's going on today, the demonization, of course, that's going towards Russia, it's virtually setting up, you know, yet another Cold War in so many words. And I think the EU, it would suit them, of course, absolutely, to be a tool towards doing that. And it is an unfortunate thing that, you know, it's almost as if they want us kept in conflict. I think that is another aim going on here in the EU. And by the way, anybody that seems to think the EU will reform tomorrow and it'll all be marvellous and we'll all be free within it has just clearly never looked at the treaties that have set this whole thing up. It's absolutely clear from the start that it was set up purely to become federal. There was never, ever meant to be any individual sovereignty left. So when David Cameron says, well, we have a special status within this, well, we don't. That will last hardly any time at all. And once we're very firmly within Europe, especially when what they call qualified majority voting comes in, which I think will be next year, that's going to change the whole way decisions are made in Europe, and it will give a lot more power to the other countries. It's meant to be more democratic, but actually what it does is create a collective where nobody can really swing it their way anymore. We will have very little voice. And once we're in there, once we're part of that, there is no special status that can remain. And it was never intended to. And, when Osborne and Cameron say, oh, no, it's going to be fine, they've clearly never read the treaties themselves, or they have, and, of course, they just don't want anybody to know what they really say. The plan for Europe is clear from the very beginning. That, I think, is a shame that most people are not being made aware of that in all the current arguments about whether you'll have more money or not. They don't seem to talk about the freedom aspect very much.
Well, because, let's just have a look at some of the more obvious things that have come out over the last couple of weeks, some articles that I've been collating, all of them alleging, and with some pretty strong evidence as well, that there's been a deliberate attempt over the last couple of months to hold back plans in order to wait until after the UK Brexit referendum by the European Union. There's this whole business of the possible accession of Turkey, which is probably a way off, but there are other countries in the former Yugoslavia, Serbia, Albania, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Montenegro, Kosovo, and Macedonia. Those talks have been put on hold. Then there's the formation of an EU army. Plans which have only been shown to EU diplomats are understood to include proposals for a new European military structure, including headquarters. This was in the Independent on the 27th, actually just a week ago, by Charlie Cooper. And also around about the same time, an article saying that the EU army has actually existed for a long time as part of something called the Political and Security Committee of the EU, which, I mean, this is the first I'd ever heard of it, and they have created something which is called the EU Battle Group, which has been doing manoeuvres on Salisbury Plain and various other places quietly. So that is that. Some of these decisions about the EU army, it seems, are being held back until after the referendum, including the negotiations this week with the 10.3 billion euro loan to Athens. Now, a lot of people over in Greece were expecting another horrific bit of arm wrenching to take away their public services, to take away the infrastructure in order to get this 10.3 billion loan this week, but they were gobsmacked to hear, Andy, that the bankers just said, mostly of course German bankers said, oh, it's okay, you can just have your 10.3 billion, no problem, until the next round.
Yeah, but that's always the way it works, of course. And, of course, this is how countries get reeled in and they get controlled. And, I mean, Greece, everybody can see how they've been controlled just over the last two or three years to get them through their crises. And what the people want is irrelevant because, they are compelled to have to do the biddings of the EU masters, ultimately. So we've got a choice here. We actually have an opportunity to step out of all of this. And I think this is where you need to think bigger. The really poor level of debate that we're seeing in the mainstream, both sides, it's distraction really from what the key issues are. And you're absolutely right, there are things coming up that it's almost like they've been held back this long just to get us in. And some might argue, because we keep hearing, well, if we stay in the EU we'll be all better off, some might argue actually the EU, it's been very unstable financially, the euro's been unstable, what's been propping that up all this time? Because that is an issue which has never really been explored. And if many other countries do join and then some crisis ripples through, of course, if we're part of that, we're more likely to be pulled down with it.
Now, Martin Summers is a Remainer, but let's bring him in on this, Martin, because I've just been pulling up some facts to do with the single market and the financial relationship, Andy. Maybe you could chip in a minute, but I'm going to fire this question off at Martin. This is just looking at some of the facts to do with the single market and how successful it's been. The European Union's been a shrinking market, apparently, for 10 years, hence they want more countries. This is one of the motivators to bring new countries in, as well as what we were hearing earlier from
Andy, that Britain is the second largest economy in the EU. We're the fifth largest economy in the world, and the EU is an internal market only. EU only accounts for 40% of UK trade, and that amount is actually shrinking at the moment. And the rest of the world accounts for 60% of Britain's trade, and that amount is growing. So, you know, we shouldn't be too obsessed, whatever you think, about making sure we can make sure that the EU trade works, because actually it's shrinking, that market, and the outside world is growing. So GDP per person from 1955 to 1975 grew 164%. From 75 to 95, it only grew 155%. From 95 to 2013, it grew 133%. So the actual amount of growth per person in Britain has been going down and down and down. So it does suggest, Martin, doesn't it, that a membership of the EU may be holding us back if our potential markets in the future are outside the Union.
Well, I don't know where you've got these figures from, Tony. There's no actual byline for it, but let's just presume for a minute that there's some accuracy in what you're saying. The reason why GDP in Britain has slumped since 1975, I'll give you one simple word for that: Margaret Thatcher. The EU has virtually nothing to do with industrial policy in Britain in that period. Now, the EU is a cat's paw for NATO, but I don't hear many people saying, when are we leaving NATO? Perhaps we should be leaving NATO. The Greeks are very definitely discussing leaving NATO. Cyprus doesn't really want to be in NATO at all, but we've got bases there. Remember, we've got bases there, too.
There hasn't been a referendum about that, has there?
No, there hasn't. And let's get real about what real... The EU is a glorified... it's a glorified talking shop controlled by the United States of America. That's the reality. That's the reality, and it's the United States of America and Britain who went to war in Iraq. France and Germany didn't want to know. Now, ultimately, of course, the real world out there is the Russians and all the rest of it. The war in the Ukraine has been created entirely by NATO, by NATO special forces and intelligence services, using the EU as a condom. Now, if you remember the famous telephone call between Catherine Ashton, who was the head of the EU's foreign policy section, and Umas Piets, who was the Estonian foreign minister, where he briefed her and he said, well, it looks quite clear from talking around the hospitals that the shooting down of the pro-EU demonstrators and police was carried out by Pravi Sector, who are a right-wing faction in the new government in the EU. And all of this has been orchestrated, not by the EU.
Martin, I'm just fading you out there, because it's not a right-wing faction, it's a far-right neo-Nazi faction.
Indeed. All right, well, but let's just point that Catherine Ashton, when it's pointed out to her, and of course the Russians must have bugged the phone call, and of course Umas Piets has said yes, it definitely took place, this phone call, when he says, well, it looks like the demonstrators have been shot down by Pravi Sector, working probably with the new government, not the old government, which means of course MI6 CIA, and she goes, gosh golly, really? And that just tells you what the EU is about. The EU is a hopeless bunch of spineless twerps who can't deal with the United States of America, and that's the fundamental problem. Nobody's talking about and of course, who is the big cat's paw for the United States of America? Oh, that would be right-wing Tory governments in Britain. And right-wing Tory governments in Britain will go to Bilderberg, and on behalf of the Americans, they will tell the Germans that they're going to war with Russia, even though they don't want to go. But they're going to be told by Britain and America that they must go. If they had a stronger EU, they might be in a position to tell them to get lost, but they're not.
This might not be the best Bilderberg next week to do that, might it?
No, it might very well be the case that the Germans, four former German chancellors, three social democrats and one Christian democrat, are saying that the policy on Russia is wrong. Because, of course, what's actually happening, we've got sanctions on Russia, which is the eighth biggest economy in the world. We are attempting to bankrupt Russia as we speak. Whether you should do that in the middle of a global economic crisis is another question. But who's pushing that? It's not being pushed by the more moderate members of the EU. It's being pushed by Britain within the EU and by the United States of America. Yeah. Now, how are we going to deal with the power of the United States of America? That's a very big, very big question. Maybe we should break up the EU and have a catastrophic breakup of the euro. That'll strengthen us to deal with the United States, won't it? Now, what's actually going to happen, in or out of Brexit, we're going to have a banking crash. And actually, we'll suddenly realise that we've been discussing rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. I'm fed up of talking about the EU. I'm fed up of talking about Brexit. In or out, the banks are bust, and somebody's trying to set up a war with Russia. How are we going to stop that? Maybe General de Gaulle will have something to say about it, but he's dead.
Well, Andy, I wonder if you'd like to just respond to some what Martin's saying there, because he seems to be saying that actually, potentially anyway, a lot of European countries are looking at Britain and saying, well, we're a big problem, and maybe they may put the thumbs up to Britain leaving because they see us as a cat's paw for the US.
Yeah, I mean, just to respond to one thing Martin said there, in theory, the idea of a good, strong Europe to stand up against some of the things he's referring to there, yeah, would make sense. The problem is, that isn't the Europe we've got at the moment. I mean, if I thought that what we had was some kind of utopia run by sort of angelic realms, yeah, I'd be absolutely all for it, but unfortunately, that is not the way it is. I think Martin is right. I think clearly there's going to be another crash. I mean, the economy has been somehow kept alive in Europe all this time. And I also do think there are problems. If we do leave the EU, I don't think that's panacea to all our problems. I think a right-wing Tory government could be a big problem here. And you could argue we might be more at their mercy outside of the EU. But ultimately, the EU is not a democratic organisation. We at least theoretically have the ability to get rid of a government here if they're not behaving correctly. In the EU, we don't have that power, and it's going backwards. You know, we're going back into a system whereby basically you've got these faceless people at the top that you can't shift off. It's almost like going back into a feudal system. And I think that's the problem. There's good and there's bad on both sides. But I still would rather take my chances outside of it rather than within it in the current state that it's in.
Well, and we talked in the first hour about with Paul Smith, who's a city councillor for the Labour Party here in Bristol, about problems with the electoral system, quite a lot of them as well, with something like 5 million young people who are entitled to vote simply not able or willing to register with the new system for voting registration. And I noticed yesterday in the Daily Mirror, I think it was, Ben Glaze reporting that bungling EU referendum chiefs have been sending postal votes to foreigners who are actually banned from taking part. The blunder was revealed after top Tory Brexiter Ian Duncan-Smith demanded to know if foreigners had been sent voting material despite being banned. Citizens from EU countries except Ireland, Malta and Cyprus can't vote in the June the 23rd poll, but some living in Britain were sent polling cards by mistake, apparently.
That's right. Now, I mean, okay, the authorities are saying, well, they're going to basically make those cards null and void. They won't be able to vote. They won't count. But it does speak something about the, well, claimed sloppiness.
Well, drilling a little bit more into that article, it's a bit close to home here in Bristol because the Electoral Commission said an IT glitch was to blame. Great, isn't it, when we have these IT glitches with an election and we think, oh, well, maybe that was the wrong result there. With officials blaming council software produced by Gloucestershire-based firm Express. That's the letter X-P-R-E-S-S. Gloucestershire-based firm Express Software has been sending the electoral, I guess this is postal voting forms, off to the wrong people, Martin.
Been picked up and something will be done about it. It's going to be very interesting to see how it will play out, because I think it's fairly clear that Scotland is going to vote to stay. It's quite clear that the Republicans and Nationalists in Northern Ireland will vote to stay. The Republic of Ireland has just been through a huge mincer to try and stay in the euro. Maybe they shouldn't have done that, but they've done it. So they've made huge sacrifices to stay in the euro. They're not going to be happy if the Loyalists, because they'll probably vote with their right-wing Tory allies to leave, vote to leave. What will happen in Wales will be very interesting, but of course in South Wales they're very dependent upon EU subsidy, and they've got to believe that the Tories will replace that subsidy. Another thing that really hasn't really people haven't talked about, we pay into the EU, but Norway and Switzerland both pay into the EU anyway, because even though they're outside the EU, because that's the deal that you have to do if you want access to the single market. I understand Michael Gove doesn't want access to the single market, but then some of the other people in the Brexit camp do. Frankly, the economic arguments are all over the place. Let's not even talk about them. Let's come back to the fundamental politics. You say that Britain was a democratic country. I never accept that Britain was a democratic country, and nor would Irish Republicans have ever accepted that. So, and therefore the idea that somehow the European Union is an undemocratic imposition on a democratic Britain is an illusion,
Martin,
of middle-class people,
Martin,
in the southeast of England.
What about the general election in 1945? Very, very unexpected result and massive changes to the country in 45.
Yes, indeed. And under first past the post, the Labour Party had an overall majority and was able to carry stuff through. That's a long time ago, Tony. Those reforms are dead. They were killed off in the 1970s, not by the EU, but by by Margaret Thatcher and the Americans who supported her.
The 1980s.
Well, indeed, yes. From the 70s onwards. The real threat facing us is NATO. NATO is actually a terrorist organisation. Police investigations in Italy have shown that NATO intelligence services were behind the Bologna bombing, were behind the kidnapping of Aldo Moro, etc., etc. Now, people in southern Europe who've got much more serious political understanding of this than we've got, don't forget they were occupied during the war. They've had to fight, they've had strategies of tension imposed on them by MI6. We are basically a privileged, we're in a privileged relationship with the Americans, and Britain has been pushed into the European Union by the Americans to sabotage Franco-German cooperation. So in many ways, you're probably right, French socialists would quite happily see us out, but the Scots will want to stay, the Irish will want to stay, the Welsh will probably want to stay, so we're going to press the button on the breakup of the United Kingdom. Possibly a good thing, maybe a very good thing, but it's going to rock the boat. If people think we're going to leave the EU and it's all going to be fine, we'll just walk away, that's completely wrong. It's possibly going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back of the City of London based banking system. So here we go, let's rip it all down, but don't cry for your mummy when we get there. I think that Brexit may well win, but don't cry for mummies when your face hits the windscreen.
Interesting, fascinating. But also, Martin, of course, it could lead to the breakup of the European Union, some people are saying.
It could. Well,
not just
it could.
The United Kingdom. Anyway, let's get back to Andy, because he's been sitting there patiently on the line there. Andy, can you just take us through some of your... Because I'm off to the Bilderberg Conference. We'll be doing this show, hopefully live from Dresden next week. And I wonder what your take is on them and their role in all this, because it's been pretty much shown... there's a certain amount of evidence that the European Union... United States of Europe project has been, they've been a large part of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, they have. And I mean, when Christine Lagarde of the IMF starts telling Britain why we must stay in the EU, what she doesn't say in the same breath is, you know, she's a big supporter of Bilderberg, so she's got her own agendas that need to keep us in. One thing I find fascinating is that despite the fact that many of our prime ministers have attended Bilderberg, and, you know, that's Blair, Brown, Cameron, Thatcher, Heath, you know, we're talking top stuff here. People still shrug the Bilderbergs off as, it's just a nice place for them to go. It has no influence. Well, it clearly does, because you wouldn't spend that amount of time and money putting on something like this if it had no influence. And as we mentioned earlier on, it has actually been admitted by insiders that they do set policy. And basically, Bilderberg attendees, I think they're all given about 10 minutes each to speak around the table. You know, they are basically mandated to implement any decisions, as it were, that come out of those meetings. So they don't just walk out of them and forget it. This is really what is shaping the world. And when you look at the high-end corporate people involved as well, this is when you realise the establishment, there is really no divide between politicians and corporatists. I mean, the current chairman is Henry de Castries. You know, he's currently the CEO of AXA, the huge international insurance firm. So we're talking about people who are right up at the very top there with enormous influence, and yet they're telling us that we mustn't know what goes on. Chatham House rules, as they always say, when clearly those decisions are influencing us. So it's an undemocratic organisation, but effectively, although they say the people that attend are paying for themselves to attend, we're all funding it at the end of the day. And to then be told that we cannot have transparency just flies in the face of the nonsense that they come out with at other times. Point the finger at, you know, groups that are not transparent. So there is hypocrisy. Martin is right to identify the fact, yeah, there's big problems with British democracy, unquestionably. And, you know, we're talking about lack of transparency in the EU. Absolutely, there's lack of transparency in the Bilderbergs. There's lack of transparency in power over here in this country. None of it's right. And just because, you know, there's hypocrisy going on here doesn't mean we shouldn't highlight all of them for needing reform. But I still think when you look at the power that people like the Bilderbergs have within the EU and then all the other foundations that underpin it, which are highly dubious, it's still far less democratic than what we've got over here, even though, yes, we do have problems and we need to get it sorted out.
And Andy, I wonder if you could just round up with telling us how people can find your work and follow some of your articles, that sort of thing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you want to know what I think about the EU, there's currently a couple of quite long articles on my website. So if you look up truthagenda.org, truthagenda.org. You'll find some of my articles about this and other stuff, the Brussels attacks, the French attacks, you know, I've got some views on there and all kinds of other things. And if you want to find out where I'm speaking next and about the publications, just go onto the website, truthagenda.org, and you'll find out where I'm coming from.
Hello, Andy.
Hi there, I'm still here.
Yeah, sorry, there was a bit of a crackle there. Just remind us of your website once more.
Yep, so it's the three W's and it's truthagenda.org. Truthagenda.org.
Okay, I think maybe you said it about 10 times there, I'm not even sure.
Anyway, well, hopefully people are getting it.
Anyway, Andy, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Been a pleasure, thank you.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. And leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Martin, inquest, second inquest into Cheryl James' death at Deep Cut Barracks today. There's been all sorts of pain for the families involved here. And what struck me as most incredible was vast amounts of public money being spent on this report done by Nicholas Blake QC back in 2006 that actually said these were suicide. It's now becoming absolutely clear it was nothing of the sort.
Well, it's a cover-up, another cover-up. We all know that, don't we?
Low morale, he said. Nicholas Blake, the reviewers concluded, and I quote him, on the balance of probabilities that these deaths were self-inflicted. Well, there was some bits and pieces have come out in this particular inquest. Corporal Ian Wilkinson, one of the last people to see Private Cheryl James alive in November 1995 at Deep Cut, which I should remind people was a British Army training base. The inquest heard Corporal Wilkinson was not officially spoken to about the incident until 2003, unbelievably. His colleague, Sergeant Phil Wood, arrived on foot a short time after him and found the gate unmanned and unguarded. I mean, that's 3 years after the death. So the main gate on this army base, there was no guards on it that day. And we heard also that, this is from Forces TV, an article just a couple of days ago, a Deep Cut commanding officer knew that NCOs were breaking the rules. A former commanding officer at Deep Cut Barracks told an inquest NCOs were banned from fraternising sexually with young trainees, but he knew some were breaking the rules. Nigel Jostling, with a J, not a G, has been giving evidence at the inquest into the death of Private Cheryl James in 1995. He was commanding officer at the camp when two recruits were found shot dead. Mr. Jostling added that he often thought about whether he should have fallen on his sword because of the regime he was asked to take charge of, and obviously he wasn't just asked to take charge of it, he was in charge while some of these deaths took place. It comes after the inquest heard that female recruits at Deep Cut Barracks were told to keep their mouths shut after Private James's body was found. Now, it seems that there was murder and rape going on at this barracks, Martin, that Mr. Nigel Jostling was the commanding officer of.
Well, it may be so, and if it is so, let's have the truth. There's not a lot to be said about this other than that, you know, it's a very dirty business and we want to know the truth about it.
Well, the Army has apologised to the family of Private James, but, I mean, it does fit a pattern, doesn't it? Looking at from the top of the hour, I was talking about things like the Hillsborough disaster, the Jimmy Savile scandal, where it does seem that there is a deliberate attempt immediately to cover these things up, and there's no acknowledgement that people in charge may be pliable idiots, but they shouldn't be in charge because they're just not responsible enough to be running these institutions.
Well, I mean, the wider political point you might make is about British British inquiries are not regarded as independent. They were always a bit of a whitewash, but they're no longer judicial. They're essentially political, which is why the Pat Finucane Centre in Northern Ireland wants an inquiry into what went on over the years of collusion between the Loyalist paramilitaries and the British armed forces, leading to hundreds of deaths. But they don't want a British public inquiry because they simply don't trust a British public inquiry to do the job. And that's nothing to do with the EU. It's just to do with Britain being a sort of rubbish place where this kind of stuff is tolerated.
The emphasis in the Inquiries Act, which I think I'm right in saying is 2005, came out the same year as the 7/7 London bombings, is that the government minister, rather than the judge, sets the bounds of the inquiry. So he will say, you're allowed to look into this, but not into this. Now,
that is, does seem as if political power is encroaching into the judiciary, and this might be one of the things that's causing these problems.
Well, yeah, but if you think back to the original Bloody Sunday inquiry or whatever, it was not adequate. That inquiries run by governments, even at arm's length, are often whitewashes, but they're even more whitewashes now than they used to be. The culture of secrecy and cover-up, and don't forget the constant drumbeat of we're being threatened by terrorists, you know, the same terrorists that were arming and training in Syria are supposedly threatening us, and of course they probably are, but they're being who's directing and pushing all of this from above. And I think you'll find that it's not the EU fisheries ministers, it's British secret services.
Birmingham 6 I mentioned, and we've got another inquest starting into that. What's your take on the Birmingham 6?
Well, they obviously didn't do it, and there's a very interesting article by Chris Mullen in The Guardian this week, because he obviously was campaigned on their behalf for many years, and there's actually an ex-IRA intelligence officer who was willing to come over and give evidence about the attack. The IRA admitted they did it in, I think, in 1985. They apologise. What apologies mean, I really don't know in these circumstances. But it is possible to get to the bottom of it. Apparently, according to Chris Mullen, two of those involved are dead, and two others were so peripherally involved that there will be no evidence to be used against them. And don't forget, even if they were convicted, there's a deal been done about people who were involved in these activities before the peace process. And I think, of course, we're going on about Birmingham, but we haven't mentioned about 7-7, or we did just mention it. More people died there. More people died in Bologna in 1980. 86 people died, and we think, the Italian police think, that NATO intelligence services were behind that, which will include the British special services.
If you'd have been watching your television on the 18th of March 1991, you'd have seen this documentary transmitted by World in Action about the Birmingham Six.
These are the faces of the men convicted of Britain's worst ever terrorist attack, the Birmingham pub bombings in 1974, in which 21 people died. These are the faces of the same men after 16 years of wrongful imprisonment, the gravest miscarriage of justice in living memory. Tonight, they tell their story in their own words.
Now, I know that no system of law in this world is perfect, and obviously they can make mistakes. What rankles in our case that it took so long, 16 years? They'd known for a long, long time that we were innocent.
They could pay me £20 million, wouldn't compensate me for what they've done, for what, 16 years in prison. Look, I'll say this, prison can make people very bitter, but I'm not bitter now, because I couldn't live the bitterness, because the way I look at it is, if you're going to be bitter, it'll make you ill. You get obsessed with it, like, no.
No one can compensate someone for 16 years. It's impossible. My oldest daughter was 8 years of age when I came into prison. She has children. My daughters have children as old as they were.
It does seem at last, though, that there may be a chance to get a bit closer to the truth. The main problem with all of these cover-ups, though, Martin, is quite often the perpetrators are dead by the time the families get justice.
Well, that's right, and in any case, what the Irish Republican movement has been calling for all along is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, similar to what has happened in South Africa, where, for example, the Dublin and Monaghan bombs of 1972 could be looked into, which the Irish police are pretty convinced were facilitated by British intelligence agents. A lot of evil has been done, and I think a lot of evil is still being done, and the truth is always important.
Well, it is. Did mention that we might be hearing from Mike Sparks again, but that will be on Tuesday on the Dialect Show at 12 noon, so you can have a listen to him then. We don't really have time for that now. But what we do have time for, Martin, is that the media is silent as the biggest protest since the French Revolution. Well, that may be an exaggeration. But anyway, they're sweeping France right now. The country prepares to host 2 million visitors in the showpiece Euro 26 football championship in a couple of weeks' time, but they've got labour strikes at oil refineries, nuclear power plants, fuel shortages, paralysing aviation and public transport system, violent street protests, nationwide riots and a state of emergency until the end of July. To cover the Tour de France, even, has proved a major headache for François Hollande, the least popular president since polls began in France. Does seem that things are being censored, effectively, that we should be getting reports on our nightly news about some of the things that have been going on over there. We haven't, though, have we?
Well, we don't. I mean, as you said earlier, there's an awful lot of rubbish that people spend their time on. So when all the energy and oxygen that we've got to discuss politics is being taken up with Brexit, which is largely irrelevant. Meanwhile, of course, we're actually at war in Syria, at war in Russia, and there's an uprising going on in France, but we wouldn't know about it because we're too obsessed with our own little stuff, aren't we?
Well, there are other bit of space in the newspapers to cover this, and it has been, to be fair, been covered occasionally in some of the nationals, but it's just not getting much attention because, I suppose, a bit like the I, Daniel Blake film by Ken Loach, it's not considered to be the, inverted commas, right story. And it's now 31 years since the Battle of the Beanfield. This is an article by Andy Worthington, which he's put up just a couple of days ago. It is the 1st of June, that anniversary. So where is the spirit of dissent in Britain today, Martin?
Well, it's on this programme, Tony, even though we don't necessarily agree about everything. I think people have been beaten down over the years, very much so. But, as we saw in the riots during the first coalition government a few years ago, it only takes one spark for things to take off. Especially when you're all over Europe, you've got mass unemployment of under 25s who are the military age people. So, the potential for violence is always going to be there, isn't it?
Well, it was the 12th annual Stonehenge Free Festival, but it wasn't allowed to happen. It was a police blockade by Margaret Thatcher. And a lot of these police were actually also the same police who'd been involved in the Orgreave.
Well, indeed, and a lot of people were severely injured.
That's from the miners' strike.
Yes, that's right. So they were bashing up the hippies, bashing up the miners. I remember it well. I was a young person in that era, and I'm afraid some things have changed. The police have become more professional, frankly, than they were in that era. But the fundamental distribution of power in the society is as bad as it ever was, and worse.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Up next is Macari and Kamal's Arabian Nights. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Cabinet Member for Homes, Labour Councillor for New Central Ward, Paul Smith. Billy Quain's in the hot seat here next week, and I hope to be reporting live from Dresden, Germany, in the Power Elite secretive annual Bilderberg Conference. Thanks to Martin Summers, you just heard there. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. You can catch this show on its show page at thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us on the Politics Show at 5 next week, and don't let the banksters get you down. National.